Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. 10 times in his 7.5 years as president of the United States, Barack Obama has traveled to some location to console the families of victims of mass shootings. Monday afternoon, he and Vice President Joe Biden were in Orlando, Florida, where early on Sunday, 29-year-old Omar Mateen used assault weapons to kill dozens of men and women at a nightclub. VOA White House correspondent Maria Salinas in Orlando.
He was with the families of those who were killed, with survivors, with medical personnel who responded. He thanked law enforcement, all very much in a private way. His spokespeople say he understands how important it is in a community that is hurting this way, that has been hurt like this and going through something like this, for the president to personally come and say, "We stand with you. You're not alone. And we will do something about this."
At a makeshift memorial site in downtown Orlando, President Obama told those gathered their city was shaken by, in his words, an evil and hateful act. The government of Eritrea says its forces killed more than 200 Ethiopian troops, wounded another 300 during fighting this week in a contested border area. There has been no independent confirmation of those figures. The United States has launched simultaneous strikes against Islamic State from the Mediterranean Sea and the Persian Gulf, marking the first time the U.S. military has bombed IS targets in Syria and Iraq from both bodies of water. The assault began with strikes from the USS Boxer in the Gulf on Thursday. USS Truman also been targeting both countries. This is VOA News. Progress being made in the delivery of humanitarian assistance to tens of thousands of Syrians who were trapped in besieged areas. Lisa Schlein in Geneva is following the story.
Jan Egelin, the special advisor to UN Special Envoy for Syria, says significant progress is being made. This, he says, comes after several weeks where virtually nothing was getting through to the thousands of people in Syria who have been without food and other aid for months, or in some cases, years.
We hope to reach 110,000 people in besieged and hard-to-reach areas.
Egelin says it is a positive sign that a 48-hour truce was declared in Aleppo City to allow aid convoys to go through. He attributes the negotiated truce and the progress in reaching the affected areas to more effective diplomatic pressure from Russia and the United States. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
U.S. Central Intelligence Agency Director John Brennan says despite losing critical ground in Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State terror group has no intention of fading away. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports that Brennan painted a bleak picture for U.S. lawmakers, warning the Islamic State remains resilient and able to strike the Middle East and the West.
He said financially, even though the group has taken major hits from the U.S. and coalition bombing campaign against its oil infrastructure, still it's able to generate tens of millions of dollars to finance its operations. And that even though it's been losing fighters on the battlefield, that it's not been able to replace them as effectively as the U.S. and its allies work to shut down the routes that the foreign fighters have been using to get into Iraq and Syria. Still in Iraq and Syria, it has about 18 to 22,000 fighters. Overall, Islamic State now has more fighters at its disposal than Al-Qaeda ever did at its height.
Brennan believes the Islamic State will continue attempts to strike at Western targets in the hopes of replicating the deadly plots that stung Paris and Brussels, as well as inspiring attacks like the shooting in Orlando, Florida earlier in this week. The shooting death of a British member of Parliament a week before Britain votes on a hotly debated referendum on whether to quit the European Union stunned the country, where gun attacks are rare and political violence is almost unheard of. Some witnesses say the alleged killer yelled "Britain first" as he shot, stabbed, and kicked Joe Cox, a junior Labour member of Parliament, 41-year-old mother of two, former aid worker, was known for advocacy for Syrian refugees, a pro-immigrant stance, and also opposition to the British exit from the EU.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's High Court is expected to rule today on another extension request in the corruption case against former President Bakili Muluzi.
You should appreciate this is quite a bulky matter. It involves a lot of documents, a lot of evidence. And if the case is changing in any way, we'll need quite some time to prepare fully.
Kamado Chokoto is the lead defense lawyer for Mr. Muluzi. In Liberia, one of the officials implicated in the Global Witness corruption report says he has been receiving death threats. Kenya's High Court upholds forced anal tests in homosexual cases. And a forum is opening today in Tanzania aimed at dispelling the myths behind albino discrimination.
In Zimbabwe, traditional healers lie to HIV-positive men that if they sleep with a woman with albinism, HIV/AIDS is cured. They also say that women with albinism give them sexual pleasure than women who do not have albinism, which is a lie.
Tapiwa Gwen Marege is a 34-year-old albino woman in Zimbabwe, and the U.S. says it enjoys good trade relations with Zimbabwe despite targeted sanctions. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It has been almost a decade since Malawi's former president, Bakili Muluzi, was first arrested on corruption charges, but the trial has yet to really get underway. A judge is expected to rule today, Friday, on another request for a 30-day postponement. Lamek Masina has more from Blantyre.
Bakili Muluzi was president of Malawi from 1994 to 2004. During that period, he and his former personal secretary, Linus Whiskey, was accused of stealing 1.7 billion Malawi kwacha, which at the time was equivalent to about 12 million United States dollars. The funds were originally aid money from the Republic of Taiwan, the Kingdom of Morocco, and Libya. The lead prosecutor recused himself a month ago. The trial was to resume Monday, but now may be facing another postponement. The new prosecutor said a key witness is not available and asked the judge for 30 days to review the charges. Tamando Chokoto is the lead defense counsel. He says he also needs more time to prepare.
You should appreciate this is quite a bulky matter. It involves a lot of documents, a lot of evidence. And if the case is changing in any way, we'll need quite some time to prepare fully.
The trial opened in 2009 and has been subjected to several adjournments, partly because of Muluzi's hospitalization over his spinal problems. Both sides rejected allegations that they have been working to deliberately delay the proceedings. The 73-year-old former president has always said the corruption charges were politically motivated. Some see political interference in the delays. Muluzi is now part of the opposition UDF party. But ruling DPP party recently joined forces with the UDF in parliament. Muluzi's son, who is president of the UDF, is now a cabinet minister. Political analyst Vincent Kondowe.
When the cases are not really given the impetus and momentum which they require, then you begin to question the political willingness that is there to prosecute people holding public offices who are accused of plundering public resources.
The state anti-corruption body says the repeated delays are not about politics, but Malawians are getting impatient. Local press reported this month that the state has spent as much as 12 million United States dollars on this case. The government did not respond to a request for comment on that figure. Eric Matola is a teacher in Blantyre.
The funds which are being used to prosecute this case are public funds, of which I contribute through tax. Therefore, I see that it's a wastage of resources on how the government is handling this matter.
Malawi has been under the microscope for its anti-corruption enforcement since 2013, when an audit reviewed public officials had stolen $32 million in public funds. The Cashgate scandal, as it was called, led to about 70 arrests and prompted the European Union and other foreign donors to cut aid. Malawi lost about $150 million in annual assistance, but much of that aid remains suspended pending reform of Malawi's public finance system. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
In Liberia, one of the officials implicated in the Global Witness corruption report says he has been receiving death threats. Richard Tolbert, former chair of the National Investment Commission, is cited in the report for allegedly receiving $50,000 in consulting fees. He has been indicted along with the Speaker of the House of Representatives, as well as the chair of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's ruling United Party. Mr. Tolbert has said he will be proven innocent. He said the death threats have been coming from unknown individuals through phone calls and text messages. Harold Dolly is former U.S. ambassador to the African Development Bank and a friend of Mr. Tolbert. He says one of the threats pointed to the death of Harry Greaves, whose nude body was found earlier this year on a beach behind the presidential palace in Monrovia.
It's without question that Mr. Tolbert, his life has been threatened on more than one occasion. His best friend was murdered, and his body was washed up on the shores right close to the beach by the presidential palace in Liberia.
Mr. Harry Greaves had been dead now for some time. Why didn't Mr. Tolbert come out when the threats were being made?
Well, in the time since Mr. Greaves' body washed up, Mr. Tolbert was arrested on some charges that he considers to be frivolous. And he was able to go into court and post an appearance bond, so he was not incarcerated.
Mr. Dolly, is Mr. Tolbert trying to make a connection between the release of the Global Witness report for which he has been indicted and the death of Harry Greaves? Is there any connection?
Well, I don't know the case and its specifics. What I am concerned about is my friend of 40-plus years. And Richard, if anyone knows him, he is a very calm and collected individual, and he is no alarmist. And in talking with Richard since all of these events have transpired, Richard feels threatened. He knows his life is in danger. His wife and children are now back in the States, and he remains in Liberia.
Do you think Mr. Tolbert feels that the charges stemming from this Global Witness report, he's being singled out? Does he feel that way?
He definitely does. There's a history behind these charges, meaning they're political strains that are a part of this. And Richard did the honorable thing. He went to the court. He stood, in effect, on the courthouse steps and challenged the indictment, stating that it had no basis in fact.
He probably played a role in helping to elect President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Does he regret the fact that this government now has turned on him?
Let's give full credit here. He not only worked for the current administration to be elected, but he was served as head of the Liberian Investment Corporation to attract money to Liberia for investment. And he was very successful at that. And next year is a presidential election. And I'm sure he feels that there's some politics going on here. And there have been articles in the last several years that have prominently mentioned him as a candidate for the presidency. There may be a link here.
Harold Dolly is a former U.S. ambassador to the African Development Bank and a friend of Richard Tolbert of Liberia. He was speaking with me from New York. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Button, Washington. Today is Friday, June 17th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The vice presidential candidate for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, Geoffrey Mwamba, has challenged President Edgar Lungu's government to arrest him if the government believes that he presented a fake certificate to enable him to participate in the August 11th general election. Zambia's new constitution demands that candidates vying for political office must have the minimum of a grade 12 certificate or its equivalent. Supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front Party say Mwamba lacks the educational qualification. But UPND spokesman Charles Kakoma says the allegations are a mere publicity stunt by the ruling party to score cheap political points.
Those allegations are totally false. Our running mate, the vice president, is fully qualified under the constitution to run in the forthcoming elections. Mr. Godfrey Mwamba has an advanced diploma in business and investment from a college in the United Kingdom and therefore qualifies. And that diploma was subjected to scrutiny, and the Zambia Qualifications Authority certified it as suitable for this election, and therefore threats by the ruling party on Mr. Mwamba to arrest him are totally malicious.
Supporters of the PF that I have spoken with said that the UPND asked Geoffrey Mwamba to present his qualification to them, and he refused after threatening that he would collect all the funds he has given to the party. That is why the party allowed him to go ahead, and that the party doesn't even have proof of his qualification.
Those allegations are false. The Zambia Qualifications Authority is a government institution that certified Mr. Mwamba's qualifications, the diploma, certified by a government institution. Therefore, if a government institution says this is the correct qualification, there is no other authority that can question that. Mr. Mwamba did not threaten the party, the United Party for National Development, with the withdrawal of any funds that he might have contributed. That is totally false. I think we stand now. Mr. Mwamba is qualified and will run in the election.
If there is a fallout due to this controversy surrounding his qualification, will the UPND be ready to have a backup plan in the run-up to the August 11 general election?
Well, the constitution states that in the event that a candidate is disqualified, the party will have to nominate somebody else to replace that person. But it also means that if such a decision, if we have to come to that, it means even the election will have to be postponed to allow for fresh nomination. But it is all unnecessary again. It won't happen because our candidate is fully qualified to run for this election.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Activists and government officials from around Africa will gather in Tanzania starting today, Friday, for the continent's first ever forum on albinism. The gathering is sponsored by the United Nations, which sounded the alarm earlier this year about a spike in attacks on albinos in Malawi. In nearby Zimbabwe, albino activists say community outreach is working to dispel dangerous myths and discrimination. But the battle is far from over. Sebastian Mofu has the story from Harare.
Loveness Mainot's husband divorced her in 2008 after she gave birth to a second child with albinism. She's now a member of the Albino Charity Organization of Zimbabwe.
I am now giving counseling to others and courage to love their children and accept their condition as they are. We are trying, helping others fighting that belief, because albinism is not a myth, it's not a misfortune, it's not a result of prostitution, neither is it a result of witchcraft. So we are educating the communities that albinism is not is a result of those situations. They regard it.
She says their efforts in schools have led to a reduction in stigma for albino students. Official statistics say Zimbabwe has about 39,000 people that live with albinism out of the country's population of 13 million. The condition is characterized by a lack of pigment in the skin, hair, and eyes. It is hereditary, caused by genetics. But 34-year-old albino woman Tapiwa Gwen Marange says more education is needed in rural areas.
In Zimbabwe, traditional healers lie to men, to HIV-positive men, that if they sleep with a woman with albinism, HIV/AIDS is cured. They also say that women with albinism give them sexual pleasure than women who do not have albinism, which is a lie. And some people think that we are a case. Maybe my mother was promiscuous, yet my parents are black and I'm white. And some people think that maybe the gods were cursing my parents.
Albinos have come under attack in neighboring Malawi and Tanzania, where some people falsely believe that charms made from albino body parts will bring good fortune or money. Journalist Candice Mwakalele is half Tanzanian.
Honestly, I never knew I was different. Growing up in Zimbabwe, I was never treated any differently by any of the children I interacted with. I was never treated any differently. I don't know if it's because I never treated myself differently or not, but I only actively noticed that somebody noticed my skin color when I moved to Tanzania. And that's when you'd find you're walking down the street and someone would be like, hey, mzungu, mzungu, which is Swahili for murungu.
She and other activists say education plays a key role in reducing discrimination and violence against albinos. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Harry Thomas Jr., says the U.S. and Zimbabwe enjoyed good trade relations despite targeted sanctions imposed on President Robert Mugabe and his inner circle more than 10 years ago. Reporter Erwin Chifera has details from Harare.
Responding to questions from the public at a function organized by social media enterprise 263 Chat, Ambassador Thomas Jr. said last year Zimbabwe exported goods worth $65 million to the United States.
It's in your favor, and we have normal trade relations. We'd like to see them expand, and that's why last year my distinguished predecessor, Ambassador Wharton, took a business delegation to the U.S.
Ambassador Thomas Jr. said he is working on improving trade between the two countries. Zimbabwe is America's 164th trading partner in the world. As for the targeted sanctions, Ambassador Thomas Jr. said the United States President Barack Obama and the U.S. Senate could only review them on the back of genuine economic and political reforms.
98 individuals, 68 entities. What will it take for the Senate and President of the United States have to be convinced that there is genuine economic as well as political reform? A good start would be an implementation of your constitution. It's the Zimbabwean people's constitution.
Ambassador Thomas Jr., who earlier met the visiting IMF delegation, said it was America's wish that the Zimbabwean government clarifies its economic policies and tackle corruption so as to attract meaningful investment.
We know that people are suffering, so we hope that the government's economic policies are clear, transparent, and will allow for direct investment. As I'm sure you know, that sanctions have nothing to do with Zimbabwe's inability to access the international financial institution. Zimbabwe cannot access the international financial institution because before sanctions were imposed, Zimbabwe stopped paying the international financial.
He said the United States remained Zimbabwe's biggest donor and had this year provided $55 million in food aid and security and was spending millions of dollars in fighting HIV/AIDS. Ambassador Thomas Jr. said, apart from Nigeria, Zimbabwe received more U.S. scholarships than any other country on the African continent. Ambassador Thomas Jr. also said he hoped the United States government would continue the Mandela Washington Fellowship for young African leaders even after President Obama leaves office next January. About 60 young Zimbabweans left the country today for the program. They will be attached to various universities and other institutions before meeting President Obama. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
A Kenyan court yesterday upheld the use of anal testing to prove homosexuality. The two men who brought the case say they will appeal the ruling. Rael Ombuo has more for VOA from Nairobi.
Justice Matthew Emukule of Mombasa's High Court ruled Thursday that anal testing is, in his words, a reasonable and legitimate means to prove what he called unnatural sex. His ruling was in response to a constitutional challenge brought in November of last year by the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. Eric Gitari is the commission's director. He filed the petition.
This is heart-wrenching in so many ways. It sets a very dangerous precedent which jeopardizes the security of so many LGBTQ persons, especially gay men. It makes them now very vulnerable to blackmail and extortion with a threat that they can actually be subjected to anal testing and that result of the anal testing be used in court to jail them for 14 years. So it's a life-changing judgment that has been delivered today.
Homosexual acts are illegal in Kenya. Those found guilty can get up to 14 years in jail. The commission was suing on behalf of two gay men who had been forced to undergo HIV testing and anal examinations while in police custody in Mombasa last February. International human rights groups and forensic experts say these forced procedures prove nothing and are degrading. The petition named the magistrate who ordered the exams, the hospital, the police, the director of public prosecution, and the health ministry. A memorandum of appeal was filed immediately after Thursday's ruling by the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission on behalf of the two petitioners. They now wait for the Court of Appeal to assign a date for a hearing. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Auma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Egypt's World Championship silver medalist Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayed prevailed in javelin with a throw of 86 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Stockholm, Sweden on Thursday. Kenyan world champion Julius Yego was third with an 83.09 meter effort. Former world 10,000 meter champion Ibrahim Jaylan clocked 13 minutes and 3.22 seconds in the 5,000 meters to lead Yomif Kejelcha, Mukhtar Edris, Yigram Demelash, Yeneo Alamireo and Salomon Berihu in an Ethiopian 1-2-3-4-5 triumph. Meanwhile, Kenyan Ferguson Cheriot Rotich won 800 meters in 1 minute and 45.07 seconds. Ivory Coast's Ben Youssef Meite was second in 100 meters in 10.25 seconds. Kenyan Beatrice Chepkoech and Ethiopian Sophia Sefa were second and third respectively in women 3,000 meters steeplechases as Ethiopian Gudef Tsegay placed third in women's 1,500 meters. In football news, Mauritius dismissed Angola 2-0 as Lesotho edged Malawi 1-0 in Group B action at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in Windhoek, Namibia on Thursday. Consequently, Lesotho topped the group with 9 points and progressed to the quarterfinals. Malawi has 6 points, Mauritius 3, and Angola no point. Tomorrow, Saturday, Lesotho challenge South Africa as defending champions and hosts Namibia, tackle Botswana in the quarterfinals. On Sunday, Zambia play Swaziland, and guest side the Democratic Republic of Congo engage Mozambique. Meanwhile, Zambia's Zesco United host Egypt's El Ahly as Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa welcome Morocco's Wydad Athletics Club in Group A action at the start of the mini-league phase of the Orange Africa Champions League tomorrow, Saturday. Algeria's Entente Setif engage South African visitors Mamelodi Sundowns, and Nigeria's Enyimba welcome Egypt's Zamalek. Elsewhere, Algeria's Mouloudia Olympic Bejaia host Tanzania's Young Africans as the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe welcome Ghana's Medeama in Group A fixtures in the mini-league phase of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup. In Group B action, Morocco's Kaoukab Marrakech host Tunisian defending champions Etoile du Sahel as FUS Rabat tackle visiting Libyans El Ahly Tripoli. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, June 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Ouma, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, dual citizenship. Would you consider acquiring the citizenship of another country? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dual citizenship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka goes one-on-one with Linda Thomas-Greenfield. The Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs is America's top diplomat to Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.